from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this special 4th of July edition of Forum, we bring you two more interviews from the archives. First, food writer and New York Times columnist Mark Bittman joins us to talk about his switch from full-time omnivore to part-time vegan. In his new book, VB6, Eating Vegan Before 6, Bittman explains how he adapted the vegan diet for his life and needs. Then at 10:30, with summer in full swing, we bring you some expert recommendations about weekend adventures in the Bay Area, including best places to hike, camp, fish, and explore. That's coming up next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Mark Bittman writes about food for the New York Times. He's also the author of Food Matters, How to Cook Everything, and his newest book about turning himself into, well, a quasi-vegan, VB6, which translates to Vegan Before 6. He joins us in studio for this opening hour of Forum, and good to have you back on Forum. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michael. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, let's talk about your eating unprocessed fruits and vegetables before 6. You didn't really follow your doctor's orders here. He wanted you to be a vegan, and now you're just a vegan before 6.
Well, he wanted me to be a vegan, but I wanted to do something doable, something that I thought I could stick with. So I thought about things, and I read some, and I thought, look, it's clear the writing's been on the wall for some time that a more plant-based diet is the way for all of us to go. But there's a spectrum here, and on one end of the spectrum is Morgan Spurlock, or represented by Morgan Spurlock on the Supersize Me diet, and the other end of the spectrum is whatever turns out to be the healthiest diet imaginable. And the only thing that matters for most of us is to move down that spectrum towards the more plant-based diet. So I needed rules, and I wanted to eat more plants, so I decided I would be super, super strict. All fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, legumes, whole grains, and no white food, and no processed food, and no alcohol before 6. And then after 6, I would do whatever I wanted to do, revert to my
your wicked,
former,
wicked ways.
Right, my wicked ways, exactly, my former horrible lifestyle. And it worked. It's worked. And it's been 6 years for me, so it seemed worth writing a book about.
You're thinner, you're svelte, your health has improved. I mean, it's really had results, and that's the most important thing in all this. But, you know, I talk about, because I have to watch my diet now, too, with diabetes, about the assertion of what I like to think of as my Nietzschean will against the culinary sirens, and you do wind up cheating. I mean, or you're certainly tempted to all the time. How do you avoid that? I mean, just by
well, first of all, I don't. Cheating is built in. I mean, the idea that you're postponing, you're only postponing gratitude till evening. So, and that the cycle happens every day. So, in the morning, you know, if you feel like bacon and eggs, you have to exercise a little discipline and not have bacon and eggs.
So, is that exercise or exorcise?
Either, both will work. thank you. But you do get to do what you want after 6. But, you know, the funniest thing is I just said thank you because we have coffee now and there's milk in the coffee. And I feel like one of the first questions I get is, can I put milk in my coffee? Because it seems very onerous to people to say vegan and then they immediately think, oh, God, soy milk in my coffee. I can't take it. And so that's kind of how I feel. So I have milk in my coffee. And again, it gets back to this. Vegan before 6 is a strategy. The science is we need to eat more plants. Everybody agrees on this now. More
plants,
less sugar.
There are people who get, like, your doctor, who's been your doctor for a while, said, look, Mark, you know, your health is at risk here. You've got to change your wicked ways. But there's some people who would say, listen, you've talked about getting older. I'm getting older. I want to be Epicurean in my last years here. I want to eat whatever the hell I want to eat.
Well, so this sort of is the closest I could get to the best of both worlds.
It is a compromise.
Sort of balance. It's a total compromise. And I think as you get older, you understand compromise better. I'm certainly less extreme than I used to be. This is a kind of, you know, it's not a diet in the sense that it's lose 21 pounds in 21 days. It's a diet in the sense that it's a plan for how you're going to eat, period. Not for a month, but from now on.
And you've been certainly cutting back, even, I presume, in the evenings on meat, because I was looking at your blog and found out that U.S. per capita meat consumption has actually declined over the last four consecutive years. There's also some interesting stuff in there about more evidence linking red meat with consumption of heart disease and bacteria specifically, or the effect of bacteria.
Yeah, that's the cutting edge of the research, that bacteria
stuff. It's fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
But you've cut down meat even in terms of the evening eating?
It's happened organically. I mean, it's not really intentionally, but it's it has less appeal. I don't want to eat mass-produced, industrially produced meat, so that's often the only option that you have. I probably eat as much fish as I used to and less meat than I used to. But that's not part of the scheme here. I think everybody's got to figure out their own, you know, their tinker with this thing a bit. It's, as I said, it's really a strategy. It's not the last word, and it's certainly not the only strategy.
Well, I'm looking at your book. It says, eat vegan before six to lose weight and restore your health, ellipsis, for good.
For good.
That's pretty strong.
Well, there is some marketing on the cover. I mean, it's a book cover after all. I lost 35 pounds when I did this. They've stayed off for 6 years. Other people have lost weight also doing it. My blood sugar numbers, my cholesterol, blah, 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 all of that was went in the, you know, everything got better instead of worse. So that's a good sign. You can't, without a scientific study, say this is going to work for you. You can say it worked for me and it's worked for others and it's worth a try. And also, it's logical. The science, you know, as I said, the science says eat more plants. This is a strategy for doing that.
Speaking about science, you've taken a pretty strong position against the labeling of or the necessity to label GMOs, genetically modified food, and got in weighed in on this controversy, particularly on the rider that prohibits essentially the Department of Agriculture from stopping production of any genetically engineered crop once it's in the ground. And you spoke said rather strong language against that. What about the weighing in on this? I mean, I think some of your columns said most Americans are in favor of labeling, and yet here in California, of course, it went down to defeat.
Well, that was a money thing, but yeah.
Well, and what about the science? I mean, you're not a science guy, and there are a lot of scientific people who say it doesn't have to be labeled, and it's not necessarily vital that it is labeled.
I'd agree that it's not vital that it is labeled, but I also would agree that people should be entitled to know what's in their food. And since people want it to be, there haven't been really studies done on the effect of GMOs on human health. There's no proof that it's bad for you, and there's no proof that it's not bad for you. So, okay, that's fine. We eat a lot of food that's never studied, and for the most part, we assume that it's safe. That's something we could question. That's sort of number one. Maybe we want those kinds of studies to be done. Number two is that people seem to be 50%, 48%, whatever it is, of the people in California voted for Prop 37. So, and Prop 37 was outspent by a factor of what, 20? Something like that. To me, the issue is that people are asking for transparency. And I personally believe there are things I'd rather know about than GMOs. But if GMOs is the issue that people want to fight about, I'm going to support that because I want to know what's in my food and how it's produced.
Well, you're talking about the need scientifically to eat more plants. And can we hear more about the vegan part of this? I mean, why should we be limiting our dairy, and what should we be thinking about?
There are a couple things about plants. One is that the things that are stripped out of them when they're processed are mostly fiber and phytochemicals. And fiber is sort of the new superhero of nutrients. It was thought that it passed harmlessly through your body and was great for digestion, and now it turns out it does all kinds of cool things. And it seems to be important that this fiber is in the food that it was in when it started out. That is, adding fiber in the form of whatever to breakfast cereal is not the same thing as eating whole grains or an apple. So that's number one. Number two is phytochemicals, which seem to be almost countless, almost numberless, and we have no idea what any of those do. Those are lost in the processing of plants, too. But as far as a sort of daily diet goes, the reason that plants are better than processed foods is that they're real. They have one ingredient. It goes back to what we were just discussing. We know what's in them. And they're not caloric dense, which is to say there's a lot of bulk there for not very many calories. Animal processed foods are just sort of out. I mean, it's almost not worth discussing what's wrong with them at this point. Animal products are a different story because obviously they're nutrient dense in a powerful way. And you can't argue that meat and dairy give you incredible amount of nutrients for the amount that you have to eat. But we eat way too much of them. And you spoke about the link between red meat and disease, which seems to be becoming stronger and stronger. But we eat something on the order of 600 pounds per person of animal products a year. It's not sustainable from an environmental or a health or any other perspective. And the demand for those kind of products is growing.
It's also terrible for the planet and the environment.
Right. There's not the land for it. There's not the – and, you know, some of this – maybe I talk about this too much, so it seems less striking. But 80% of all antibiotics are prescribed to animals or are fed to animals. They're not prescribed. They're just given to animals. 80% of all antibiotics in the United States. And as a result, we're seeing antibiotic resistance. We're seeing what are called superbugs.
Yeah, this is on your blog, too, about all the E. coli in turkey and all the salmonella in chicken. And these are antibiotic resistant.
Yep. Yeah. And that's trouble. That's real trouble.
Agreed. You would have gotten in trouble with my mother, too, because you say you don't need milk. And all through my boyhood, I was told by my mother, drink milk, and you have to drink 3 glasses of milk a day. And you're saying, you know, water.
Well, she was buying into something that we all, you know, you and I are roughly the same age. And I was forced to drink milk also. But it's not, you know, we get something on the order of 2 or 3 times as much protein as we need every day. Most Americans do. So the protein issue is not really a big issue. We're going to get enough protein. It's not something that's that important.
For kids, though, with milk?
Mm-hmm. I mean, kids get enough protein also. Milk is convenient. Let's say this. I think the last word has not been written about milk. There are many people who are allergic to it, including me. And we don't know whether, even at this stage, whether skim milk and low-fat milk are actually as beneficial as whole milk. We've gone in this whole direction of taking the fat out of everything. And now it turns out that most fats are not bad for us. In fact, most fats are good for us. So there's a lot still to be learned about all of this.
Also read on your blog that distraction leads to more consumption, increases the amount that you eat.
Well, I think we know that. That's called eating while you're watching television, isn't it?
Well, just any kind of distraction, yeah. Apparently. I mean, so the data shows. And also, there's a thing on your blog, talk about marketing. It says the secrets about sugar content. And, I mean, you look at the can of baked beans and you learn it's no secret.
Well, I mean,
how heavy it is in sugar. You know?
This is why I think the process. I probably shouldn't say things like it's not worth discussing. But, you know, yogurt, people think, oh, well, I'll have a yogurt because this is a healthy snack. And you look at the nutrition labels of most yogurts. I mean, certainly not plain yogurt, but any yogurt other than plain yogurt. And you're looking at basically the same nutritional content as ice cream. Granola bars, pretty much the same as a Snickers bar. And my newest bete noire is, cappuccino, frappuccino, caramel, chocolate chip, whipped cream sundaes disguised as coffee.
I thought your newest bete noire was Gwyneth Paltrow.
No, she's not my bete noire.
Well, you do take her on.
Well, actually, we're old acquaintances, so, but I, you know, I, yeah, maybe I
no,
don't want
to. But she has
go
some
there.
Weird and quacky ideas about food. I mean, you point this out in your blog.
She does have some. I think she has some weird and quirky ideas. And also,
I said quacky. You said quirky.
Quirky.
You
know. Well, quacky, quirky. She's off in her own world, I think. That's what I would say.
We're talking to Mark Bittman. He's here with us in studio. His new book is VB6, Eating Vegan Before 6. Other books include Food Matters and How to Cook Everything. And let's talk about some recipes the book has 60 recipes in it for those who want to follow the Bittman diet here or Does it have that name on it yet, that moniker?
No, we were very happy with VB6, actually. How many slogans do you need, for crying out loud?
You want your name on these things, don't you? Because it does suggest following certain kind of rules as you followed them won't work for everybody, as you said, but I kind of find it appealing, and I think many others will. And the dishes are important that you eat, too. So, for example, you talk about oatmeal and smoothies for breakfast and things along those lines, but people associate you with special kinds of recipes. So what's worked particularly for lunch?
I like to think that people think of me as someone who does simple recipes, and this continues that vein. There are some things in here that are quite innovative and quite fun, but actually I would say that the key is that there are three or four recipes that everybody should know how to do, and that not enough people know how to, and maybe 5 or 10% of the United States population is cooking at this point. And to the extent we can increase that, we'll all be better off.
Quick divergence before we get to recipes. You're with Michael Pollan in terms of much more cooking and family eating together and all these kinds of things that he's laying out now.
I was with him on that before he was with him on that, I think. Yes.
But 5 to 10%?
That's a guess. I mean, it's very hard to say. Well, if 50% of meals are eaten outside the home, which they are, and some huge percentage of meals that are eaten inside the home are takeout food, or you bring home a chocolate cake, a Coke, a bag of chips, and a pizza, and you put the pizza in the microwave, and that counts as cooking, there's not a lot left for from scratch cooking, and you don't see a lot of from scratch cooking. But let me do this. I want to advocate for three recipes, and those three recipes are chopped salad, stir fry, and rice and beans, and all of their nearly infinite variations. Because if you can do those three things, you can really eat well, pretty well, forever. And those are, you know, they're varied, they're simple, they're things you can rely on all the time. They taste good.
Maybe a little more detail, though, you do with them.
Each of those. I mean, if you talk about rice and beans, they're obviously scores of varieties of beans, heirloom beans, and regular beans, and so on. And you know the difference between
avoid
chickpeas.
The canned baked beans, as we learned.
Yes, you can bake your own beans. Put a little maple syrup in there, and rice. You know, I would take to mean all whole grains. So this sort of, I had a dish the other day of rice, brown rice, chickpeas, chopped kale, sort of stir fried with jalapeno and cilantro. It's a rice and beans dish. It was really fantastic, and that was a great lunch. Chopped salad is sort of take things out of the refrigerator, start chopping them up, put them in a bowl, oil and lemon juice, you're in business. I mean, and there's infinite variations on that too. And stir fry, you know, this is a great opportunity to use meat or fish or tofu in a big mixture where instead of having center of the plate meat, you're having 2 ounces of meat per person or even less. A much more moderate amount mixed with vegetables in a style that most people like. So, I mean, I'm not even sure which of those recipes are in VB6, but there's a way in which I feel like advocating for those three recipes is really an important part of my work because it's sort of getting people started on cooking and cooking stuff that really makes sense.
Well, if you look at your blog, the first recipe that comes up is, and I think it may be in your other book, salmon fillets with lentils, but the lentils have to be green, and it's better if they're undercooked, and it's a healthy meal.
It's a nice meal, and those are very, very thin pieces of salmon that cook in like 30 seconds. That's a nice recipe.
And you
could
also
actually
use shrimp or, you know, other, yeah.
You know, my whole thing trout. Has been over the years has been to vary, you know, to say, here's how you make vegetable soup. Okay, now I've shown you how to make vegetable soup, take it from here because almost anything you do. You know, it's not, a friend of mine said the other day, it's not a question of being right or wrong in cooking. It's a question of figuring out what you like. And once you have the basic techniques down, that's really true. And there are only 5 or 6 basic techniques you need to know.
It's also important now, and it's why people eat out as much as they do or pick up fast food, to make some quick stuff if you're going to do the kitchen cooking. If you're going to take that role on in any serious way, so it's less onerous and people are constantly feeling they're pressed for time. I remember last time Jacques Pepin was on, we talked about, you know, how fast these recipes have to be sometimes. And you're talking about alacrity too, aren't you, speed?
I always talk about speed. And I rarely spend more than 20 or 30 minutes on a dish. So, and that's always been the case. And I think, you know, it is important. We are pressed for time, but you know, it takes time to go out and buy stuff. Also, it takes time. Nothing is without trade-offs. It sort of goes back to where we were 10 minutes ago. There are compromises involved in everything.
Let me ask you something, though. A lot of the big argument for GMOs is the world needs food. And Thomas Mugabe, for example, no less, the head of Zimbabwe, the dictator, said he would not accept GMO foods. We got people starving. Should they not eat GMO foods?
No, I mean, I would say—
Because most foods are genetically modified, aren't they, to some degree?
Not most foods are not genetically modified, but most plants grown in the United States are genetically modified. That's not true internationally. There are countries with bans on GMOs.
Oh, the European Union bans them, of course.
Right. So that's a lot of people. The problem right now is not that there's not enough food in the world. The problem is getting it distributed in the right way. The other problem is that we in the United States are using millions of acres to grow corn and soy, which is in turn used to either feed animals or produce junk food. Whereas if we were using a portion, even a slightly bigger portion of those acres to grow what the USDA calls specialty crops, that is fruits and vegetables, we could be producing way more food for humans to eat, real food.
There's a plant pathologist, Pamela Donald, who's over at UC Davis, and a historian named James McWilliams. They did an op-ed in your paper, The New York Times, and they said opposition, I'm just reading here, to genetic engineering has driven the technology further into the hands of a few seed companies that can afford it, encouraging monopolistic practices.
I don't know that I buy that. I mean, I'm certainly in favor of federal funding for plant-based research, and there's a lot of great research happening in traditional hybridization also. So it's true that there's concentration of power in the hands of a few corporations. Blaming consumers who would like to see GMOs being labeled for that problem really seems quite far-fetched to me. In fact, it's laughable.
You've been asked this, I'm sure, many, many times, but I think you give your approbation to the Mediterranean diet. Why did you decide perhaps not to go on a Mediterranean diet?
I really needed rules. Everybody can figure this out for themselves. And as I've said, I'll say it again because I think it's important. The science is pretty clear. Less processed foods, less animal products. However you want to do that is going to work. I needed a strategy with rules. I know myself and I know how I've done things in the past. So this thing of saying, okay, in the daytime, I'm going to really be strict with myself and there's going to be few exceptions, not none, but few exceptions. And then at night, I'm going to let it rip. If I were able to say I'm going to have a more moderate diet where I get 60 or 70% of my calories from plants and the rest of my calories from animal products and the occasional junk food treat, whatever, I would do that. But I can't.
Well, you know
I
yourself.
Can't. Right.
David says, do you find you become a glutton after 6 to make up for having been a vegan all day?
The odd thing is, or maybe it's not odd, but the answer is no. I think I eat pretty moderately at night. I often intend to be gluttonous. I think, oh, this is it. I'm going to really chow down. But I get full very quickly. I don't think it's about stomach shrinkage or anything else. I think it's just about being more easily satisfied mentally, maybe. It's sort of not about eating past the point of fullness.
You've been listening to a special encore edition of Forum from our archives. Our guest was food writer and New York Times columnist Mark Bittman. His new book is VB6, Eating Vegan Before 6, which details how he personalized the vegan diet to fit his life and allow for some cheating. Stay with us for another program from our archives this 4th of July.